Well, when it comes down to products and brands, I'm finding it, I'm like you, Jeremy, I find it very tricky to make predictions. And as you just said, sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong. I usually don't share my predictions because what is the success rate?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
So a lot of brands just don't get it. That's one of the things I've learned as a longtime brand marketer and as someone who now covers them for a living. That's why I'm excited to talk to Dr. Emmanuel Probst. He's the global lead of brand thought leadership at Ipsos, and he's a consumer market research professor at UCLA, and also the author of Brand Hacks, How to Build Brands by Fulfilling the Consumer Quest for Meaning, which came out this past fall and is a Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestseller. I talked to Emmanuel about a number of different things, including how we are more isolated and lonely than ever, despite being very connected, why so many advertising campaigns fail despite all the technology we have at our disposal, and how to tell the difference between things that are here to stay versus fads. I think you're going to really enjoy this one, so I'm excited to jump right in. So Emmanuel, welcome to Future Proof.
Jeremy, thank you for having me on the show.
I wanted to ask you, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis besides that little intro I gave you?
Well, that was a great intro, but in a nutshell, as you briefly described, at Ipsos, Ipsos is probably the largest market research firm in the world. And at Ipsos, I lead our thought leadership efforts for brand health tracking. And what we do here is we support clients with brand performance, brand equity, and brand activation. At UCLA, I teach consumer market research. And in my spare time, if you will, I also write what's most relevant to our audience today is I'm curious about why do people do what they do? And really, that is what Ipsos, UCLA, and my writing all converge, if you will. That is my passion, is to understand why do people do what they do and how do consumers choose brands. From there, how can we build brands that people will be more compelled to buy and more loyal to?
I love this one sentence in the book, which is great, by the way, for all of you listening. But I love this one sentence, we all search for meaning, not brands. And I feel like so much of the rest of the book stems from that one sentence. Can you dive into that theme a little further?
Yeah. The starting point for the book Brand Hacks is to say, we're overwhelmed with media. We're overwhelmed with advertising because we check our phones 83 times a day. We post 45,000 pictures a day on Instagram, and we're exposed to media and advertising all day long. So from there, the bad news for marketers, if you will, is most people don't care about most brands. Most people don't care about advertising. Most people don't seek new brands. What people, and I'm choosing this word carefully when I say people, not consumers, what people are really looking for is to achieve something that's meaningful to them, that has a deeper meaning, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in this conversation. And the point of the book is to say, let's understand these meanings that people are trying to fulfill. And from there, build brands that help people fulfill these meanings. And in that process, these brands become meaningful in and of themselves and become more relevant to people, and consumers become more attached to these brands.
And I know that there's a lot of research being done that suggests the more connected we are, the lonelier we feel, you know, and I'm wondering if that loneliness just leaves a major opening for brands.
It does. So the more connected we are, the lonelier we feel. That's because we see sadly that the younger audiences, for example, Gen Z, millennials, especially Gen Z, who are online all day long and arguably all night long, don't have many close friends, if any at all. So the opportunity here is to step in and provide people with comfort and coziness and empathy and joy. And all these are very simple emotions, yet most relevant and most important now than ever before after this global pandemic we're just going through, or we just went through, depending on how you look at it. What people really look for is something simple, something that's reassuring. And a brand that illustrates this is Etsy. Etsy is a platform where people can buy handmade artisan goods, if you will. And Etsy's sales increased tremendously during the pandemic. And that's because you don't need another 10 coffee mugs. What you need is one coffee mug that feels personal, that feels authentic, and that feels like a product you can relate to. And that's what people that who shop on Etsy are looking for. So the more connected we are, the lonelier we feel. The remedy to this is comfort, coziness, joy, empathy. And how do we deliver on this with products that feel more personal in a nutshell?
Is that part of why so many advertising campaigns fail, despite all the technology and analytics we have available? Because I know that this is one of the things you talk about in the book, and I'm thinking there's actually so many different ways why brands fail just by being out of sync, out of touch. But in essence, if you had to nail that down, why would you say they fail?
Yeah, so many campaigns might be successful in the short run and often fail in the long run. That's this obsession for performance marketing, whereby advertisers are very often trying to drive traffic and sales in the short run. And that's because often marketers are goal-setted yearly or monthly, even definitely quarterly, at the expense of brand building. So it's really that thinking of the long and the short of it, Les Binet, to say invest in your brand and not only in performance marketing, and really 60% of your advertising dollars should go towards building the brand and 40% towards performance. The reason why most campaigns fail is because they fail to carry meaning and they obsessed with pushing products and promotion.
Yeah, it seems to me that there are a lot of campaigns where I'm just thinking, well, was somebody just trying to do like an interesting connected TV campaign, and they weren't thinking about the why behind it, like the underpinning? And it's interesting because I think that a lot of what you talk about in the book is, even though I think you're somebody who's very well equipped to talk about the technologies that people should use, a lot of this stuff is just, it's been true since the dawn of time, where humans are just compelled to look for meaning in life.
Indeed, you spoke about all the technologies we have at our disposal to target advertising. Well, with that said, Facebook, Instagram, should I say Meta, and Google do very well at this because they can target based on psychographics and need states. Other digital display ads actually don't perform that well because they're not necessarily targeted very well. They're not necessarily relevant to the audience. And of course, they interrupt your experience online, which is annoying. Nobody likes to be interrupted. That's, I think, one of the reasons why they fail very often.
This is, to me, like an interesting thing, because I know you talk about this a little bit in the book, is that marketers, I feel like in some ways, are more isolated as well, just like consumers feel lonely. And I agree with you, but at the same time, I'm thinking, in theory, with all the tools at marketers' disposal these days, shouldn't it be easier than ever for marketers to connect with their consumers, to glean these insights, you know, directly from the people that they're trying to sell to?
It's both. It's easier than ever. And at the same time, it's more tempting than ever to get bubbled. So it's easier than ever because you have tools to monitor conversations on social media, of course, to collect surveys, to conduct qualitative research, to analyze CRM data. So to your point, you have plenty of technologies and tools to listen to consumers. Yet, we also get bubbled. And let me be humble here. I'm one of those. We get bubbled in conferences, in the books we read, in the webinars we attend. And when you look at the landscape for marketers, really most of them live in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, big cities, big ad markets, right? And many of them read Campaign and Ad Age and Marketing Week. Again, I qualify for all of the above. Yeah, I'm not pointing fingers. I'm one of those. My point being is, as compelling as it is to access all this content, it is also a form of isolation. There is this curse of knowledge whereby brand managers and marketers do not realize that they know 100 times more about their brand and a given category than any consumers do. And they spend way more time thinking about it. When a consumer is in a grocery store, he's going to spend realistically 13 to 17 seconds in a given aisle. He's going to spend 1 to 7 seconds choosing a given product. So that's what I mean by the curse of knowledge. We know so much more, and we don't realize that we know so much more about these brands, these products, that consumers do.
And another thing that to me is really interesting that I know you write a bit about, you know, there are all these things these days, like there might be particular memes, or there could be the rise of digital goods and NFTs. And I think one thing that brands struggle to deal with is, what are things that are here to stay versus what are things that are fads that they shouldn't necessarily be chasing? I'm one of those people who I'll sometimes jump on something and I'll say, like, well, that's a fad. And sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong. And what's the underlying message for brands that you would want them to take away in terms of being able to tell a fad from something that they really ought to be investing in?
Yeah. Well, when it comes down to products and brands, I'm finding it, I'm like you, Jeremy, I find it very tricky to make predictions. And as you just said, sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong. I usually don't share my predictions because what is the success rate? I never really understood Twitter, for example. To this day, I don't really get the product. I mean, I get it, but I don't really use Twitter yet. It's a product that's very successful. And I was not very compelled with Clubhouse, for example, and I don't think the product is doing very well. I was very compelled with Peloton, and we know that Peloton is struggling right now. But that's all to say that making predictions on brands and products is very, very tricky. Coming back to the book, though, that's what's compelling about the 10 meanings that are covered in Brand Hacks. These are here to stay. These are solid, if you will. So that's also my intent with this book, is it is almost an evergreen, whereby it was relevant 2 years ago, and it will be relevant in 5 or 7 years from today. So by focusing on the meaning, you can build brands and products that will stick, hopefully, for years to come.
I couldn't agree more. I think that was the number one thing that stressed me out about my first book. I'm like writing a social media how-to guide in 2013, and you're thinking, well, this is going to be outdated by the time it comes out, right? But I think a lot of the things that you talk about are things that are going to be relevant if somebody picks it up years from now. Like, you talk about psychographics and why they're important and how they can be incorporated into building stronger brands. That's something that is probably a lesson that I'm predicting, even though you wrote this and a lot of people will read it, probably it's still going to be applicable for brands 5 years from now, because I think a lot of brands don't really invest enough in thinking about psychographics.
Exactly. Again, when it comes down to products and brands, your guess is as good as mine. And you said it with social media. I mean, who knows what social media, 4 years ago, we didn't know about TikTok. Who knows what's coming up next? That's too hard to predict. And it's not even super relevant, in my opinion. As you said, what's most relevant is, well, psychographics and life stages, meaning the ability to understand and target people based on their beliefs and values and basically what they want to achieve, as opposed to looking solely at demographics. So demographics, as we know, age, gender, region, income, all these are nice to have, but when you want to indulge in a $6 frappuccino at Starbucks, whether you are a student working on campus and you earn $9,000 a year, or you're some marketing executive at $90,000 a year, or you're a top CEO at $9 million a year, if you want to indulge in that $6 frappuccino, you'll find the $6. And that's where psychographics, for most purchases, with the exception of homes and cars and high luxury items, are way more relevant than your core demographics. It's about what you believe in and what tribe do you want to be part of and what do you aspire to, not so much your skin color and what you want, what your income suggests you can afford.
I think a lot of people aren't familiar with one of my favorite terms, which you talk about as micro moments, which can be really used to a brand's advantage. It's one of my favorite nerdy marketing terms, by the way. But can you define micro moments for the layman and how they can be leveraged to a marketer's advantage?
Micro moments are those small moments you go through during the day when you are more compelled to buy a given product or service. I'll take two very simple examples. Think about coffee. If you are Dunkin' or Starbucks or Pete's Coffee and you advertise a coffee combination at 7 a.m., 8 a.m., 9 a.m., you have a good shot at selling that coffee. If you're Starbucks and you advertise an indulgence at 4 p.m., well, that makes sense, especially on a Friday, as people are more likely to indulge, if you will, and take a break. If you advertise that same product at 9 p.m., who cares? Because unless you work night shifts or you have a long night of work ahead, it's highly unlikely that you're going to buy that coffee at 9 p.m. So the importance of micro moments is talking to people at the moment of need, at the moment of truth, when they are most likely to make a decision. So we see this also in categories like home services. If you have a leaky faucet at home, you're more likely to call the plumber on your way back to work because you want this leaky faucet to be fixed prior to your dinner at night, right? So understanding micro moments is all about understanding when people need what and therefore what are they most likely to buy at one point in time. Those micro moments, though, they stretch, 30 minutes to an hour. So you don't want to miss the window, if you will.
What are some of your favorite case studies about brand? They can be in the book. I know you have a few good examples there, but they can just be from your work in general, case studies from recent memory that epitomize some of the lessons that you're trying to get across.
Yeah, so Patagonia is a brand that was built on purpose. So while very successful, they have it easier than other brands because Patagonia was built around this purpose of responsible consumerism and protecting the environment and all that good stuff. The point I'm making, it's a lot harder for United Airlines or American Airlines all of a sudden to tell everyone that they care about the environment. Why? Because planes, by definition, are gas guzzlers. Patagonia is a good example of a brand that's purposeful, but we can also talk about Airbnb, for example. And Airbnb is a brand that makes a lot of sense because it's meaningful. The reason why the brand is meaningful is Airbnb doesn't sell a hotel room. We already have Marriott for that. We already have Hilton for that. Marriott alone operates 13,000 hotel rooms in the world. So what Airbnb sells, if you will, is an adventure, a discovery, a connection with the local community, with the host, and something that is authentic and very personal. Now, of course, they provide you with a bed, they provide you with a pillow, that's fine. But the point of Airbnb is to fulfill your quest for cultural meaning. That is, I want to discover, I want to experience, I'm an adventurer, I'm an explorer. That's what Airbnb does for you. Airbnb enables this discovery for their members.
You know, it's interesting because I think obviously the dawn of the pandemic, I can't think of so many companies that were more impacted than an Airbnb. But it's interesting because as I'm thinking about it, it really seems that because they had that kind of cultural purpose, they were able to say, how do we bring that to life in another way? And they were able to change their tactics. And had they not had that, I don't know if they would be able to swap their tactics and be successful.
100%, because everyone in travel and tourism is suffering in the short run from the pandemic. This applies to Airbnb, it applies to Marriott, it applies to airlines, and so on and so forth. Of course, if people are not allowed to travel, performance advertising is useless. And to the point we were discussing earlier, that's where brand building is important, because Airbnb continues to invest in building its brand and does not obsess with performance marketing in the short run. That's how I think their Q1 results are very, very compelling, because they invested in the brand. And that's how you build a brand in the long run, by investing in those brand values, in that value proposition, if you will, not solely in performance marketing to drive traffic.
I feel like there's this interesting danger that there are going to be some people out there who are going to look at these brands and just mimic the tactics of those brands without doing the behind the scenes work that's important, like the underpinnings of the brand. And it seems to me almost like those are the things that are going to be more important than the tactics for a brand that wants to be successful in the long term. No?
Yeah, I mean, we see this in direct-to-consumer brands, where most of those brands want to appeal to a millennial type of audience. And at the end of the day, they all stand to be different. Many of them end up falling in that sea of sameness, if you will, whereby they use the same fonts, they use the same colors, they use similar types of messaging. It is very hard to stand out, make no mistakes. That's because we see this in retail, for example, where there are more and more options available to consumers. And we see in our studies at Ipsos that the consideration set, that means how many brands people will consider, keep expanding. So if you look at retail, for example, people in 2018 would consider an average of 4.4 brands. Today, it's about 6. What this means for any retailer is you now have 1.6 additional competitor on average. So it is very hard to stand out by all means. The key to standing out is indeed to build a brand that is meaningful and whereby it helps people fulfill that quest for meaning.
And I think that even though we've talked a lot about really the meaning and the underpinning of brands, I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't spend a second before I let you go talking about how advertising is transforming. So what's next? Let's say a marketer has done the underlying work required to build a more meaningful and connected brand. Where should they be bringing that brand to life over the next few years? Which channels do you think are going to grow versus go away versus transform?
So clearly, the reason why Meta and Google are doing so well is, again, based on their ability to target these micro-comments, to target people based on need states, on life stages, on psychographics, to mine conversations and present them with products that are most relevant to them at the moment of need. So when it comes down to performance marketing, and I'm likely stating the obvious, but the future is bright for the likes of Meta and the likes of Google. Of course, we know also that the more data you accumulate, the more precisely you can target people. So that's the future, if you will. Now, what hasn't changed and what will not change, and in fact will become more prevalent, in my opinion, is the big idea, the quality of the idea that the brand advertises. What I mean by the big idea is, what is your key creative concept? What is your key value proposition? What is your brand purpose? What do you stand for as a brand? And that's going to become increasingly relevant. One, that's how you differentiate. Two, because consumers are more likely than ever before to choose brands based on what they stand for, conversely, to cancel brands that don't align with their values.
It is so interesting, and I really hope that people go not only pick up the book, but just, you know, listen to your advice in general. If you don't want to listen to Dr. Emmanuel Probst, listen to me. But honestly, both of us, I feel like, are totally aligned here in that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if you were to ask like the average executive, do you want to spend more time thinking about your underpinnings of your brand and doing that deep work? Or do you want to figure out how to do a cutting edge campaign that's going to get you on the cover of a trade publication? I think a lot of people would pick the latter. Like, they want to say the former, or they want to say, But yet a lot of people are going to go in the wrong direction. And I think it's something where we just get attracted to that shiny new object. And to some extent, everything old is new again. You know, you really do have to focus on the basics before you, you know, go beyond that.
Yeah. And it's tempting to jump the gun on performance marketing, performance advertising, because it delivers instant results. Also because all those metrics, click-through rates and CTAs and all that, are very easy to understand. I think that is why people tend to default to this. You can train any student, undergrad student, on all the performance metrics you see in digital advertising in half a day. It's very straightforward, a lot more straightforward than traditional brand strategy, if you will.
Yeah, and marketers do love metrics, but I know I have to let you go, but this is really fantastic. So yeah, Emmanuel, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me today, and thank you to our audience for joining, and I hope this was compelling.
Thanks again to Emmanuel for making the time. I really encourage you to check out his work and his book. Really fascinating, and honestly, things that most people should be paying more attention to when they're trying to figure out how to build something and really connect with consumers. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get this show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to our producers, Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.